Well, it is another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in, whether that be live at Joy 620 here in Knoxville, or you're listening to the podcast, the archive show over at investinghope.com, the TuneIn app, iTunes, Google Play, wherever podcasts are found, you can find this show. It's simply a conversation on life with yours truly, Andrew Wood. And so thank you for tuning in. Man, what a couple weeks it's been here in not just in Knoxville, not just in the state of Tennessee, not just in the country, but around the globe as we have seen the pandemic, COVID-19, coronavirus, whatever you want to call it, we have seen it sweep the globe. And so we have made some drastic changes as a nation. I mean, I was driving, working at Hope. We are a medical clinic, so we are considered essential. But for those of you that are not from Knoxville, Knox County, the city of Knoxville, have implemented an order of safe at home, and it's what they're calling it. And simply saying, if you're not an essential person, which sounds interesting, who's essential and who isn't, but if you don't work for an essential company, organization, business, nonprofit, ministry, however you want to look at that, they have a list on the website. If you do not fit that category, they want you home. If you can work from home, work from home. They don't want people on the roads. Of course, the kids aren't in school, and churches aren't meeting, and restaurants, you can't even go into a restaurant and have dinner. You have to, you can only do curbside pickup or drive through or have it delivered. So, man, we have watched. It's been interesting for a political junkie like myself. It's been interesting to watch our economy go from, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show, but our economy go from, some would argue, the best it's ever been. Okay, the best it's ever been to now, in just a few weeks, all the gains that have been made since 2008. Now, I'm not just saying all the gains that have been made just since President Obama left office. So I'm not even getting, political here. I'm just saying all the gains that we have made since everything came to a screeching halt in 2008 have been lost and then some. They're estimating that unemployment numbers this next quarter are going to be insane, between 20 and 30% if we don't get a handle on this. That's depression numbers, folks. And so they're saying worst case scenario with the coronavirus, 2 million people could die. Now, I don't believe that's going to happen. That would only happen if we just went on about our business and didn't make any changes in our lives. But what we have seen is even I have over the weekend, we went to Cades Cove because we thought, okay, we're going to social distance. We're going to be away from everybody. We're going to stay in the Wood Family Church van, so there's no scare there. We're just going to drive around Cades Cove, look at animals, look at the scenery, and be on our way. Well, while we're out, of course, it was interesting. I looked at my wife and I said, we've now lived in Knoxville long enough. And since 2008, we moved here to Knoxville in 2008. We've now lived here long enough that we run into people that we know. When we first moved to Knoxville, we didn't know anybody. Nobody. And now I've become this big deal on the radio. I'm kidding. That's not true. But since we moved to Knoxville, we got to know people. And so we stopped at an old church there in Cades Cove, got out, looked at the cemetery, because that's what Southerners do. And so we're looking at the cemetery, and this guy looks at me and goes, "Hey, you spoke at our church. We know you." And I was like, "Yeah, I have. What church you go to?" But we didn't shake hands. We didn't even come real close to each other. And then we go to another place, and a pastor pulls up in his van, and he's got his six kids, and he gets out, and we wave at each other across the green there, but we don't go shake hands. We don't get close to each other. Then another guy pulled up, and I knew him, and again, no shaking hands, no nothing. And so it's been interesting to watch that happen and occur, and the changes that we have seen. And one thing that we've seen too is we've seen the true colors of some folks. And what I mean by that is we're trying to get relief packages together in D.C. to help out families. Because the difference, folks, if you're paying attention, in 2008, what happened was the banks and the mortgage companies and Wall Street kind of went belly up. And they were saying, if we don't get some kind of assistance, if we don't get a bailout from the government, we're going to go belly up. What that could mean is loss of a lot of jobs and so on and so on. But that wasn't the fault of the government. That wasn't really the fault of you and me, the regular citizen of this country. What we're seeing now is the government telling people, stop going to work, close your doors. And so if you're a small business owner and you're going, well, how long will I be closing my doors? Is that for 2 weeks? Is that for three? Some of them may be able to make it for a month, but 2 months, 3 months of no revenue, of completely shifted revenue? I mean, and so that's where we are. And so the package that they're talking about in D.C. that needs to happen now because, hey, April 1st is coming up. April 1st, for a lot of people, their mortgage is due. Their rent is due. The electric bill is due. The water bill is due. And you told them to go home and stop working. And so what we need out of D.C. is a simple package that says, hey, we're going to put money in your pocket and money directly into the pocket of the American people. And that's what they've been trying to do. We thought we had a deal earlier this week, and then Nancy Pelosi, after taking a week off, flies in and kind of throws a bomb and says, yeah, we're not going to do that. That's not good enough. And then what we found is they were trying to, both sides really, not just Democrats, but we're trying to put pet projects in a relief package. Hey, nobody's paying attention. We'll just put this Green New Deal package in, or we'll say, hey, we need some money for the Kennedy Arts Center, $30 million here, $30 million there. No one will watch. No one will pay attention. But here's the thing. From a political strategy standpoint, everyone's watching. You know why everyone's watching? Because there's nothing else on. Sports aren't going on. The Olympics just announced they're pushing it to 2021. There's nothing on. There's no NASCAR. I mean, NASCAR over the weekend, you know what they did? They had a virtual race, and they have Jeff Gordon and the other commentators call the race, and it wasn't a real race. It was virtual, and it had tons of viewers. That's where we're at. We're at the point now where sports fans are going, I don't even care if it's real. Just play a video game on the screen, and I'll watch it. And so because of that, there's no distractions. There's no gyms. You can't go to the gym right now. There's no gymnastic classes. There's no youth sports. There's no school plays. There's no musicals. There's no nothing. So everyone is watching Washington, D.C. and saying, what are you going to do? When are we going to get a little assistance? And that's what we found. But also what we found is in the midst of all of this, we've had the abortion industry come out and say, hey, abortions are not elective procedures. They are essential procedures. And they must continue. And you had Nancy Pelosi and some others say, not only should they continue, but our tax dollars need to pay for it. We need to make sure abortion clinics stay open. And I've loved what I've seen across the country as Ohio and Louisiana, and hopefully soon the state of Tennessee, are putting out executive orders and saying abortion clinics, you cannot perform surgical abortions during this pandemic because it is not essential. It is an elective procedure and you're not going to do it in our states. And I hope the governor of Tennessee, I hope Governor Lee will do that as well. So it's interesting. There's an article over at National Review talking about this. And it says more than 50 leaders of national and local pro-life groups in the U.S. have written a letter to Alex Azar, Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services, asking him to prevent the abortion industry from compounding one crisis with another. The letter focuses primarily on Planned Parenthood, calling it the largest abortion chain in the nation, and that's correct. Planned Parenthood affiliates operate about 600 facilities across the country and provide about 340,000 abortions annually. 340,000 abortions annually. Somewhere between one-third and half of all the abortions performed in the U.S. each year. By ceasing both surgical and chemical abortions now, Planned Parenthood will free up much-needed medical equipment and decrease the demand placed on emergency rooms due to complications from both medical and surgical abortion, the letter states. This will protect women who will, without doubt, need follow-up care, including infection treatment and transfusions from the nation's emergency care centers and hospitals. And then the letter goes further. While we are in a hectic race to save lives, Planned Parenthood and other powers in the abortion industry remain insistent on taking the lives of innocent unborn children. While surgery centers postpone elective and diagnostic procedures, abortion centers are churning out surgical and chemical abortions and putting women, especially the poor, at risk. Their continued operation depletes sorely needed personal protective equipment and leads to complications that will further overwhelm already overextended emergency rooms. The letter also notes that since the coronavirus crisis escalated in the U.S., abortion providers have been using social media to advertise and promote chemical abortions for women who are at home, which will put more women at risk of complications and severe side effects and possibly leave them without necessary follow-up care. After outlining these facts, pro-life leaders ask Azar to take several steps to limit damage that abortion providers can do until the crisis has passed, including, quote, ensuring that emergency response funds are not diverted to the abortion industry, and urging the abortion industry to cease operations and join healthcare providers in donating their personal protective equipment and other equipment to coronavirus response. Among the leaders who signed the letter are, the Susan B. Anthony List, the SBC's List Research Arm, the Charlotte Loser Institute, the National Right to Life Committee, Family Research Council, Live Action, Students for Life in America, and a ton of other folks as well. Also, I saw 30,000 pro-life OBs, OBGYNs, have reached out and called for the same. And so what we're seeing here is Rahm Emanuel, and if you don't remember him, he worked under President Obama, then he became the mayor of Chicago. And Rahm Emanuel once said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Now, that was a kind of a throwaway statement, but it's been the hallmark of every crisis we've ever seen. Politicians look at that as a, hey, this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity. I even heard some folks in Washington say the other day, the reason why they came in the last minute, the 11th hour, and said this bill, this bipartisan bill that we've worked on for 3 days, 4 days, isn't going to work. The reason why they did that is because they saw an opportunity. And we actually had politicians say, this is our opportunity to remake this country like in our image. Meaning, we have an opportunity here. The market is crashing. And if it continues to crash, the Republicans will not have any power. And they'll have to do whatever we say. And so we're going to throw all kinds of things in this bill that we won't, that will be spending more and more money, and that has nothing, frankly, nothing to do with the virus at all. They were throwing things in there about elections, throwing things in there about carbon emissions, throwing things in there about the Green New Deal. And hear me, folks, look, this is not a political show, but when anyone says, hey, the Green New Deal is good for the country, the Green New Deal is good for America, you do understand that America is just a segment of the world. We have cut more carbon emissions than the vast majority of the world has. We are already doing things to have a smaller footprint on this globe. But also, the Green New Deal literally says that every building in this country is to be reformatted and restructured to meet certain codes. Well, that's impossible without tearing some of the buildings down. That's just one thing. It also talks about cows in the field and cows eating and then what happens after they eat and all kinds of stuff that's just nonsense. And it has nothing. We can have that debate if you want, but I don't think a time during a global pandemic is a time to debate the Green New Deal. Now, call me crazy, but I don't think it's time to do that. So what we found out earlier this morning is they worked through the night, I've been told and have read, they worked through the night, and they are really close to the deal. Leader McConnell said, we are on the five-yard line, we're about to go into the end zone, and what that means is $2 trillion. That's what the relief package is going to be. I've heard numbers that said for a family of four, that'll be $1,500 per adult, $500 per kid. So what's that? That's 15, 15, it's three, and then 1,000 more, some possibly 4,000 for a family of four. Now, the Wood family is very fertile. We have a big family, so that may be bigger than that. But the reality is relief is coming, and it can't come soon enough for families that are that have lost their jobs, families that have lost their livelihoods, families that are struggling with the effects of this virus. That's a real-life thing that are affecting our families and our friends and our neighbors. And so that should matter to us. We'll talk more about all of that when we come back. Fight on, fighter. Don't let anyone steal your fire. Fight on, fighter. The spirit is alive inside ya, yeah. So as the conversation continues, we're looking at what's going on around the globe. You know, it's interesting. There's not a lot else to talk about. Except for the pandemic. I even saw somebody tweet earlier this week, hey, I'm looking at writing some other articles that have nothing to do with the coronavirus. If you got any ideas, please let me know. And I'm not sure if anybody commented, because what else at this point in time is there to talk about? And so one thing that I thought, I've been watching this really closely, and I've been thinking, you know, where did it start? How did it get to the states? When did it get to the states? And that's what a lot of folks don't know. I mean, we have an idea, and I'm about to read you an article that talks about that. Excuse me. That we have an idea of where we think it started, when we think it started, but the reality is we believe the first known case in Wuhan in China was in November of 2019. Now we didn't know that at the time. We didn't know it was even transmissible from human to human until late January of 2020. So there's a known case, because we know this now, there's a known case in November in Wuhan, China. And then China kind of clamped down and was like, hey, we don't need to let this get out. And then they told the World Health Organization, hey, it's not human-to-human transmissible, so don't worry about it. So the World Health Organization came out, said this isn't a big deal. It can't pass from human to human. They said that at about January 14th, January 15th, somewhere around in there. Then the word got out, hey, no, this is a bigger deal than we thought. President Trump closed flying. No one could fly to Wuhan or back here. That was the beginning. And then we've, you know, that kind of got the ball rolling here. And so, but when did, what do we know? What's the first known case? Okay, so the first known case in the States. Now, and I believe, and I think most people believe, even Dr. Birx was talking today in a town hall, that she believes that there's a really good chance it's been in the States since November, since December. And you've probably seen on social media posting, hey, I had shortness of breath. I had some respiratory issues earlier in the year. I was negative for flu, but they really didn't know what was going on. So some people think they might have had it. Now, we don't know that. We haven't tested for that. What we know is they announced today in a town hall that in 8 days, we have tested close to 300,000 people. That's more than South Korea has tested in 8 weeks. And so we've really ramped up our testing. Here's the thing, though. Here's the thing that you got to keep in mind. If you were to get tested today, you're not going to find out today. It may be 7, 8 days, 10 days before you find out. It just depends. Depends on where you got tested, where it was sent. And so there's a lot of tests out right now, even here in Knox County. You know, we have numbers that are coming out every day, but the reality is there's hundreds, possibly thousands of tests that are out that we haven't got results back yet. So what that means is every day that number probably is going to go up. But we still need to be vigilant. We still need to be washing our hands. We still need to be doing a number of things, social distancing and the like, to make sure of that. But I thought it was interesting when we look at where it started, at least where we think it started in the country, in the U.S. Nearly half of all coronavirus deaths so far in the United States can be traced to a single nursing home in Kirkland, Washington, just east of Seattle. Life Care Center, a low-slung building in a quiet part of town, is now the epicenter of the pandemic spreading throughout the United States. What is happening behind its four walls and how a deadly virus escaped them opens a window on the terrifying inaction of public authorities and the tremendous cost it has had. It all began with patient zero. The 35-year-old has just returned to Seattle on January 15th from visiting family in Wuhan, China. Maybe he sneezed or coughed as he took a shared shuttle home from Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. All we know is, 4 days later, after feeling a little under the weather, he was in an urgent care clinic getting blood drawn and taking throat and nasal swabs. The next day, he was confirmed as the first case of COVID-19 in the U.S. County health officials reportedly quarantined more than 60 people whom patient zero had come in contact with over those crucial 4 days after he returned from China. None were confirmed to have the virus. But just a few days later, it became clear the authorities had missed someone. Firefighters soon began receiving calls from the Life Care Center, a 25-mile drive from where patient zero was being held in quarantine at an alarming rate. Residents were reporting shortness of breath and fevers. Facility staff were telling firefighters and visitors alike of an unidentified respiratory virus. Life Care made 30 calls to 911 in February, up from 7 the month before. But life went on at the facility as usual for its 120 residents and 180 staff. Visitors came and went, and patients were routinely discharged or moved to other nursing facilities. As priests move through the Life Care Center on February 26, dabbing smudges of ash on foreheads for Ash Wednesday, the virus was sweeping through as well. Patients have been getting sick for more than a week at this point, perhaps even long as a month. Anyone visiting Life Care could tell something was wrong. Loved ones were reaching out to the Seattle and King County Public Health Department demanding an investigation, according to an account in the Los Angeles Times. Officials there seemed uninterested. Staff were swamped with paperwork from government agencies rather than being given the help they desperately needed. Four residents of the Life Care Center had died by the time county officials went public with the news on February 29th that more than 50 individuals associated with the center were being tested for positive coronavirus infection. 25 firefighters who had responded to medical calls at the facility were placed in quarantine, as six of their colleagues later followed suit. But it was all too little, too late. Nursing centers throughout the Seattle area began reporting cases of COVID-19. The virus soon spread all the way to North Carolina, where a resident who'd visited Life Care Center became the state's first confirmed case. According to Trevor Bedford, a viral genome expert at Seattle's Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, the virus that coursed through Life Care Center spread to more than 1,100 people across Washington State and infected thousands more on cruise ships, shares the same genetic family tree as the virus found in the unlucky 35-year-old coming home from Wuhan this past January. County authorities failed to take the virus seriously enough and isolate all those whom the man came in contact with after his return to the U.S. And once it was clear that the virus had spread, the failure was compounded by a lackluster testing regimen. Now, as new patients are found daily across Washington State and the rest of the country, state and local officials are finally acting. King County, which includes Seattle, recently purchased a motel and large tent to isolate coronavirus patients away from already overburdened hospitals. The state's governor, Jay Inslee, has announced the shuttering of Washington's restaurants and bars. Hunker down, King County Executive Dowd Constantine has declared. Many of America's cities and states are restricting or attempting to restrict public activity in much the same way. Open signs have virtually overnight disappeared. Restaurants, schools, theaters, gyms, and other places where large groups gather in close proximity are closing from New York City to Los Angeles. Inslee banned gatherings of more than 50 people in his state. Now, the Centers for Disease Control is recommending the same and more. As for the Life Care Center, today it resembles something like a holding cell for the dozens of senior citizens living within its walls. Families are allowed to see their loved ones only through locked glass, isolated and lonely on the other side. Blue ribbons adorn the pine trees surrounding the center in remembrance of the 35 facility residents and staff who have died so far from coronavirus and of the many more who have fallen ill. And see, that's why it's important for government to act in this time. That's why we're having to stay home. That's why businesses are closing. That's why we're encouraging less contact. It moves quickly. And in nursing home, that's the most vulnerable population. And folks, this show is about the vulnerable, certainly those in the womb, but certainly those that are elderly. We care about them all. And that's why we're willing to make these changes for a time so that we can shutter this disease and ultimately end this virus in this country and around the globe. We'll be back. Black and white, rich and poor, there's no divide. You're the mighty, you're the powerless, singing, oh, oh, God, forgive us. Oh, oh, God, forgive us. So as we look at what's going on around our nation and around the world, it's an opportunity. It really is an opportunity for the church to be a light in a very dark and chaotic and uncertain time. And I think it's important that we know that. I wrote something last night as I was thinking through, and we had to make some tough decisions at Hope this week and really, you know, figure out what's the next steps. And staff is anxious. We're all anxious. I mean, I have my mother-in-law lives with me, and she's part of that vulnerable group. And so we have to think through this. Do I feel like, as a 35-year-old man, that I am at risk? I don't know. I don't think I'm at a huge risk. Now, there have certainly been people my age that have gotten sick and been hospitalized and worse. But here's the thing. It's not just about me. But it's about my mother-in-law that lives with me. It's about my mom, who's a breast cancer survivor. It's about my stepdad, who has had major lung issues in his life. It's about my dad who has high blood pressure. It's about my grandparents who have health issues. And so this isn't about, oh, well, let's just get back to work and not worry about it. Because, you know, when I say the fatality rate is low, I'm not discounting the fact that there are people dying. That should matter to us. It should bother us, certainly. But one thing that I want to point out in this time is I think about churches that are figuring out what to do and their streaming services, and churches that I never thought would ever entertain the idea of streaming are trying to figure out ways to stream. It's interesting that, and here's what I wrote last night. The survival of the fittest mindset is anti-gospel and anti-community. The gospel has an opportunity in these days to pierce through a great deal as people everywhere are trying to figure out how best to love their neighbor during this pandemic. While some seek to dunk on others or make political gains, the church is seeking to be a light in the chaos. So pray for your pastor. He will appreciate it. Maybe even send him a text or an email telling him you prayed for him. Leading is exhausting. It's hard. And oftentimes pastors are struggling and feel alone. I'm grateful that in my role at Hope, I have a team of amazing people there to lift me up and bring life in these times. That happened yesterday for me. Believe me, it makes a difference. You see, when we try our best in these moments to weigh all of the options. So as a pastor, you're weighing the options of, we have vulnerable people in our churches. We have the elderly. We have folks that have issues, health issues. They have cancer right now, or they're pregnant, or they are post-cancer, but their immune system is weak. So you're weighing those issues. You're also weighing the issues and the reality that a lot of your congregation may be losing their job tomorrow. A lot of your congregation may not have a job next month, may be on the unemployment line next month as businesses close. You got to weigh all of that, and you got to wrestle with it. So what do we do? You also got to be a good steward of the funds that you're receiving from folks that are giving. That's what we're thinking about at Hope, is what do? We have patients to think about. We have staff and to think about. We have donors to think about. And with all that, trying our best to, in a time of uncertainty, and no one really knows a timeline. Today the president said, my hope is, yeah, I would love to get back to normal by Easter. He wasn't saying that's what's going to happen. He's just saying, of course I hope that by Easter we're back to some sense of normalcy. But no one knows. No one knows a timeline because they can't possibly put a timeline on it. And in today's society, we want everything right now. We want answers. And what I told somebody the other day, if you think back to World War II, now I wasn't alive then, but I've read history about it. Everyone knew the enemy, right? You knew your husband, your brother, your cousin, your neighbor was going to go off and fight a war. But you knew the enemy. Everyone knew the enemy. The country did everything they could to prepare for that. We had companies and businesses completely change. And okay, now we're building weapons. Now we're building airplanes. Now we're building tanks. Now we're building bombs. We're getting ready for the war. And everyone could get behind that. And we knew the war is going to come to an end, and we're going to ultimately be the victory. We're going to ultimately see the victory in that. When 9/11 happened, when those planes flew into those buildings and President Bush stood on the rubble at Ground Zero in New York City, he said, we're going to go after the people that did this. We knew the enemy. We were able to come together, get behind, and go, let's go get them. The difference here, first off, one of the main differences is we have social media now. So everybody's quarantining and all they're doing is getting on Facebook and Twitter, and everybody's an expert about everything. That's one difference. Another difference is we don't have a clue. No one has a clue. We're trying to figure that out. We're looking at data from Italy. We're looking at data from South Korea. We're trying our best to look at data from China, but who knows? They lied to us in the beginning. So any data that comes out of there, you got to look at and go, I don't know if it's true or not. We're looking at data from Europe, all over the place. We're now able to study and go, okay, it can survive on hard surfaces for this long because of what we saw on one of the cruise ships. But as that data comes out, we have to make decisions. Our president, our governors, our mayors have to make decisions that weigh all of that, that look at what the medical professionals are saying and that look at what the economy folks are saying and go, okay, where's the middle ground here? How do we protect our people without foreclosing and bankrupting everybody? And that's a hard thing to do. And I don't have the right answer. I don't know. But what I would say is pray for your pastors, pray for the leaders on both sides of the aisle, that they would come together and get something figured out. We did vote for them, after all. That's the reality. We put them there for a time like this. And it's interesting, some of them rise to the occasion. I'll say that Governor Cuomo in New York has surprised me every single day. Mayor de Blasio of New York City, not so much. Governor Lee has surprised me, and not just surprised me, but has really pleased me in the way he's handled this and the tornadoes and everything. And so you get to really see what type of leader you have elected in times of crisis. And I'll say this, say what you want about our president, but he has handled this very well in the press conferences and hours after hours of questioning from the media, and clearly they don't get along. But he's had town halls. He's been in front of the people. He's working with Governor Cuomo. He's working with the governor in California, and doing everything they can to make sure we get this together. And so as we think about that, one thing that I wanted to point out was there was an amazing story that came out earlier this week about an Italian priest. And I was looking for hope and gospel moments in all of these scenarios. And this was one of those things where you read it and I was just like, that's the gospel. An Italian priest who contracted the new coronavirus died after he gave up a ventilator so a younger patient could have one, local media reports say. This priest, 72 years old, was a priest in a town in northern Italy about 50 miles northeast of Milan. According to Italian news, the priest died sometime between March 15th and 16th and was being treated at a hospital as his condition worsened. A healthcare worker at the hospital told the Italian online news outlet that the priest was given a ventilator, but the priest refused it so someone who was younger than him could use it. In northern Italy, where the priest lived, healthcare professionals have struggled with limited resources to treat the mass influx of patients battling COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. According to a Johns Hopkins University tracker of the outbreak, there have been 63,927 cases, leading to 6,077 known deaths in Italy as of Tuesday. Who lives and who dies? In worst-case coronavirus scenario, ethics guide choices on who gets care is what they're having to actually ask, because they weren't prepared for a pandemic to this level in Italy. They're actually having to ask that question. According to Vatican News, the priest greeted everyone with the phrase, peace. He was a priest who listened to everyone. He knew how to listen. Whoever turned to him knew that he could count on his help, the mayor said. He was an enthusiastic priest, often spotted on his motorcycle. He loved his motorbike, and when you saw him go by, he was always cheerful. He was born in 1947, was ordained in 1973. And as reports of his death came across social media, many people, including clergy, praised his sacrifice. So I point that out today to simply say that, look, that's not what we want to see. We don't want to have to make that choice. We don't want to have to make that that decision. I don't want my grandparents, I don't want my mother-in-law, I don't want my parents, my father-in-law, the people in my life that I love. I don't want them going, look, I'll sacrifice my life for you so your 401k can be a little bit better tomorrow. That's not what we're about, folks. That's not what we're about. But what this man did, this 72-year-old man did, knowing probably, look, if I give up this ventilator to a younger person, I'm probably going to lose my life. But he did it anyway. That's the gospel moments that we have a chance to share during this time. It's a time of uncertainty. If everyone that claims to believe survival of the fittest, if they live that out right now in this pandemic, our stores would be looted, our houses would be robbed, The vulnerable would be killed and tossed aside. But you see, God is involved in all of this. So even those folks right now are going, look, we need to quarantine ourselves. We need a social distance. We need to protect the vulnerable in our life. And I just pray that as we have this conversation, as we think about the opportunities we have to share the gospel with folks, that this love of life, this desire to see the vulnerable protected would drive us to a place where we would recognize the most vulnerable among us are those in the womb and drive us to protect them just as much as the elderly at this moment. We'll be back.
I hear you whisper, you have nothing left. I will send out an army to find.
We are living in interesting times. That's the line that keeps coming to my mind as I think through the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen a lot of changes as we try to get used to a new normal here in Knoxville and around our globe. In light of that, we have decided, out of an abundance of caution, to change things up a bit with Hope's annual banquet scheduled for April 30th. We've decided to take our banquet online as we seek to keep our staff, volunteers, and partners safe in these uncertain days. It is critical that we come together during these times of uncertainty. Unplanned pregnancies are not taking a holiday while this virus sweeps the globe, and we know that abortion clinics are not closing their doors. This means that the services at Hope are perhaps needed now more than ever before in this community. Services, mind you, that would not be possible without your gifts, prayers, and time. With this in mind, I'm in front of you today to ask a favor. Will you commit to joining us online at investinghope.com/hopelive for our virtual banquet on April 30th at 8 p.m. Eastern? Your commitment and participation will ensure that our patients continue to get the services they so desperately need. Many of us have made adjustments in our lives already to streaming and viewing online events as we all seek to flatten the curve of this devastating virus. This online event will look different from our in-person events, but the stories of hope, the celebration of life, and the gospel will permeate every minute. We will be sending out more information in the coming days with details of how you can help us get the word out about this amazing event and how you can partner with us as we seek to serve this city and our patients. Thank you for standing with us, and I hope to talk to you very soon.
So as you can tell, that was me talking. That's audio. That's a video, actually, that we have on our website, and we posted on social media with a pretty big announcement. That's right. You've heard me on this show for the last few weeks talking about our Hope Banquet, our annual Hope Banquet, fundraising banquet, April 30th. It was going to be at the press room, and then the coronavirus came in and just said, hold on, pump your brakes. And then the mayor came in and said, hold on, pump your brakes. And then the governor, and then the president. And the list goes on and on. So, hey, guess what, folks? We're pumping our brakes. And what we're doing is we're looking at this as a chance. Okay, we can't have an in-person event in April 30th. We didn't want to reschedule. You've already had that on your calendar. We've been pushing that date. So we're saying, look, you're already live streaming. Most of you, if not all of you, are streaming a church service on Sundays. There's no sports. There's no distractions. So this is a great opportunity for you to join us on April 30th, not at an event. You don't even have to dress up. You don't have to bring anybody. You don't have to bring anything except your checkbook or your debit card. And all you have to do, put the kids in bed or have them watch it with you. That's fine. We'll have ours watching with us, I'm sure, because they'll want to see daddy on the TV. And so as we do this, we're doing a live event April 30th. All you got to do is go to investinghope.com/hopelive. investinghope.com/hopelive. Go to that link on April 30th, starting at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you're listening to this and you're not in Tennessee or you're not in East Tennessee, or I doubt you'll be traveling in April, but if you are traveling, you can pull it up in your hotel room or wherever you may be. Maybe you got a great deal on a cruise and you thought this is a great time to do that. You can watch it on the cruise ship. Whatever that looks like, we would love for you to join us. We would love for you to join us for that event, April 30th. We're doing a virtual event. So all this means is set a reminder to come back to investinghope.com/hopelive, April 30th, 8 p.m. The event, listen to this. You'll like this. The event will last less than an hour. I'm guessing it'll be around 40 minutes, maybe even less than that. So you, literally you can wear your Crocs and your sweatpants and just sit in your living room and watch, and no one will know. Now, here's the thing. If you are going to host a table at our banquet and you're thinking, well, now what do I do? Well, you can host a watch party. Have folks over to your house. You can still do that in limited numbers if they're healthy and not coughing. Have them, and they don't have a fever. Have them at your house and have a watch party. Now, if you invite people to your house, you may not want to wear your sweatpants and Crocs. Think through that, whatever that works for you. But host the watch party. Share the link with friends on social media. Email friends. Give friends a call and tell them, hey, there's a great event happening April 30th online. We would love to have you be a part of that. So if you are able, host a watch party. Gather friends and host a party just as you would host a table at our in-person event. And guess what? If you do that, we can provide you with a hope packet for your party, including pledge card and envelopes, hope brochures, and hope story cards. So tell your friends about it. We would love for you to do that. We are entering into uncharted waters, but we know that God is not surprised by any of this. He is engaged and active in our present circumstances, and we trust in His goodness and faithfulness. April 30th is a great opportunity for us all to adapt, host the watch party, and share Hope's message of life with the world. I look forward to seeing what God has in store for us all. And remember, investinghope.com/hopelive. Tell your friends. Let's make this the biggest hope banquet ever as we tell everybody to tune in April 30th, investinghope.com/hopelive. And remember, you will need, this is a fundraiser, so we want you to partner with us. You can donate online or send a check to Hope Resource Center, 2700 Painter Avenue, Knoxville, Tennessee, 37919. We'll talk to you next week.